Welcome to the bullpen session. Glad you're here. Glad you're listening. Hope everybody had a good holiday season. Happy New Year. Happy 2024. Excited for the new year. Looking, always like this time of year when slate is clean for productivity and new goals or achieving old goals, but seems like a good time to get refocused. And yeah, looking forward to whatever, you know, hearing about what you're looking forward to trying to do and achieving this new year and where your goals are, and looking forward to the projects that are coming along for the farm and my own. I'm excited to get to 11. The film is going to get presented at a couple of colleges and with a military organization. I'm really looking forward to sharing the film with people, and also excited to share the conversation I had with actor and friend Ajay Naidu. He just finished a great production of Waiting for Godot at Theater for a New Audience and playing Pozzo. And it really was, the conversation with Ajay is fantastic because he just finished it. So we got to hear, you'll get to hear a lot about the process of what that experience was like. And I enjoyed it thoroughly because not only is he an actor who's worked at a high level for a long time, but the production was very special. Excellent work by everyone involved, and specifically him as Pozzo. I thought the work was really specific, and so I was happy to talk about that and the play, and then getting to hear just a lot about process, which is a joy because, you know, we can talk about how to build a career, but there's also something about the experience of, you know, being an artist, which is lovely to hear about and share and see what that, you know, because I think when I'm thinking about 2024, I'm thinking that's what I want to get back in touch with, is the experience of creating. You know, we think so much about the product and building the career, and Ajay talks about this too, is the why, being a part of the why, and you'll hear that. So it was just, it's a really good conversation and process. I am happy to share it with you. And with that, play ball.
More than a play for me, it was kind of a peak experience in my life, particularly because of the way we investigated it and a series of events that led up to us actually doing it, because we were meant to do it before pandemic, and it got stopped as a result of pandemic. This is one of the first to start briefly to give you like a kind of overview. When I went into audition, it was one of the first sort of traditional theater auditions I had been on in, I don't know, maybe 10 years. I hadn't tried out for a part in a long time, just based on career trajectory and
right,
things.
You were getting offers and knowing people.
Yes, but you know, I'm not trying to say, oh, I'm cool, I'm just getting offers. It was just mostly friends and people that I had been involved with that we were continuing to work together, and, you know, things like that. So I had always wanted to work at Theater for a New Audience, just because when I got out of school, all I wanted to do was Shakespeare. That's what I thought I was going to do the rest of my life. I was like, oh, you know, I'm probably like end up going to Vermont and do Shakespeare. Wasn't like that. I ended up in the city working quite a bit, but my main thing was to do classics, and you know, to do them in New York was the dream. So for the longest time, I wanted to work there, and it was just never happening. So when I did get an audition for Godot, I was like, well, oh, this is not an offer, clearly. So when I went into audition for it, the production had been conceived to have Michael Shannon and Paul Sparks play together, because it was because of their relationship that they had planned to do it. So when I went in, they you know, clearly those two parts, Vladimir and Estragon, I thought, oh, well, they're not going to see anyone for those things. But they ended up, because maybe one of them might not do it. And once they announce that they have to do it. So if Michael wasn't going to they might have gone with an entirely different team just because the production. So I ended up reading for Gogo and Dee Dee and Lucky, but I never read for Potso, and which is what I ended up playing. And I went back in and auditioned again. I mean, went to callbacks, and still I didn't read Potso, and I never even thought of myself as that. And I thought, oh, you know, they're going to get some guy who is thing. So when I ended up getting the offer, I was really surprised and was kind of a little con not confused, but like kind of baffled, because I thought to myself, oh, I never would have thought that was the part that I would have gotten. But I couldn't have played Lucky, because you can't have a brown man on the end of a rope, and Michael Shannon and Paul Sparks were both playing those other. So I ended up in it, luckily. So it and so when I started to work on it, I had no idea whether or not it w was going to whether or not I how to open my mouth to do it. So anyway, pandemic happened, and then we weren't doing the play. And but you know, it was one of those things where everyone said, no, don't let this leave you, because the desire is very much to do it. So when we decided to do it, when they decided to do it, when we found out last June, I started to look at it again. And as I looked at it, I thought to myself, oh my God, this is going to take, because of the fractal nature of the piece, this is going to take all summer to begin to learn it, that to be even begin to know it. And strangely, everyone decided as soon as they knew that we were doing it to start working on it. So we all came in off book, because, and thank God we did, because there was no way we could have even be, I don't understand how anyone could get the props, the movement, the stage directions, the costumes, the everything in a tech situation, and then go into performance would have just been, it would have been the ultimate disaster. So I and we could have even used more time, even going forward. So the process was, and then Aaron is an incredible director, of the highest order, and so sensitive. And so the way we were looking at it was something entirely different than what I had sort of preconceived, you know. And I was so grateful for that, because it's nothing like any of the other shows I had seen or worked on or done. So yeah, I'm still really just coming off of it, and it was a marvelous experience. Thanks for, I have a little diarrhea of the mouth in
No,
regard
I
to this.
like it because I wanted what just something you said in the process about the props and everything. Was everything there at the beginning?
We started immediately with everything. Everything was on site except for the actual whip that I use, and I have a long-winded story about that. But nevertheless, everything was there. And but we worked hard to see whether or not those were the ones that would actually work for us. So they were customized as we went. But Susan Hilferty, who designed the costumes, long before we got in there, had spent some time talking with each one of us about our concepts and how we were reacting emotionally. I told her a dream I had about my grandmother, and I ended up looking very close to what my grandmother looked like in this dream. So, and but I wore that costume all the way through rehearsal. So we would get in costume every day from the first time we stood up. So
And it's great, you know, it's lucky to have been able to see the production, and grateful for it. But the work, your work, I will talk about, it was so specific and so specific physically and bold choices, but detailed throughout. And I really was, I don't know what the right word was, aware and impressed.
thank you. Thank you so much. And it continued. I mean, to Gatto is a heavily carapaced and layered, I mean, to the point where it just never, it just doesn't stop. So coming to grips with that was also another thing, is that, like, you know, I could have, we could have rehearsed another year, and, you know, and still after that, it would have been opening. It, you know, it's really one of these ones that you, that just, You have to come empty. And my teacher and mentor, one of my teachers and mentors was Alvin Epstein, and he played the original Lucky in this. And I had a unit of Beckett with him at school, and was with we worked 2 months with him on Beckett. And looking back over my notes, which I poured through before this, all my other teachers, I had 30 and 40 pages of just so much to say. And Alvin, there was a page and a half, and it was very simple things like, there are some things to know, but no rules, and come empty, because he will take you. Do what he says, things of that nature. And it was incredible to me, because even Alvin, he was one of the only actors that talked to Beckett. But Beckett didn't direct any of the ones he was in, and he would tell the directors, well, I think that this and he was talking about Lucky's speech, not mine, but he's like, I think this speech makes sense, and we should strive to make it make sense. And he was pushed the other way again and again, like, no, don't try to make sense of it. Make it a stream of consciousness. There's no reason to justify any of the thoughts. And then when Jeff Beal was allowed to actually try to make sense of it, it revealed itself as this uncommonly clear train of thought. And so it's a very mysterious play. And so with Pozzo, most of the times I've seen it, and this is, I mean, I was frightened of it, definitely daunted by it, because it's so deeply contradicted. But then, in looking back on what Alvin said, is like, don't try to find any kind of linear justification for anything that's going on here. This is a just try to play each moment for what it really means and what it is in that moment, not something that informs it from previous or from the future. Be in the now each time, and the end will inform the beginning. And as you are in the now more and more with each one of these things, it will reveal what happens later as a result of these things. So, for instance, Pozzo has this incredibly hard time sitting down. And then I started to realize, oh, every single time he sits down, he has a hard time sitting down, which is great, because it turns everything that's happening in those moments into a struggle too. And then, so every time I've watched this, I've watched him blast his way through as this kind of, like,
Bombastic.
I mean, it is bombast. I mean, there's no question that what's coming out of his mouth is bombastic and forward and open and big. Even when he's having his crises, he's communicating these crises, whether or not it's going internally or outward. He's communicating them in a very large way. So, naturally, I was looking at it, but I've watched a few productions, and every time I was always like, well, this is an amazing sketch of a guy, of the downfall of the aristocracy, or the downfall of a wealth class, or a thing. It's a very clear sketch from 70 years ago about the downfall of the last breaths of that particular moment of a kind of aristocracy that was still very much kind of actively crumbling at that moment. You know what I mean? And so when I thought about that, I was like, well, what's it like now? And it's not like a tech bro, and it's not like a thing, but it reminded me a little bit of, like, the nationalism in India, or the last breaths of the KKK, or the some it still has a stink of this in the now for me. But I didn't want to like be like, this is who he is. It's like, I was just like, no, this is a guy who, these are the universals of people in a class system that is crumbling. And but then there's also this crazy, crazy need exhibited all the way throughout for Lucky, which I never saw in so many Gatos, where he talks about him like, oh, this guy, he was like the ultimate dancer. He taught me how to think. He taught me how to feel. I had no, you know, I desperately, you know, and our relationship is, it's like a horrid marriage. And then thinking about that, I mean, is like, you know, someone's always holding the rope in a relationship that's that bad. You know what I mean? So it's, and sometimes lucky's holding the rope. So I was like looking for these things because, I mean, obviously, I mean, anytime I'm playing anything, I'm like, well, where is he trying to find where he's most vulnerable, or what's the thing that's, where's the Achilles heel? But Pazzo has tons of them. I mean, all the way through, he's got these, you know, dime turns between just lambasting and then powering, as far as I could tell from the script in my reading of it. Now, I've watched it many times where I just didn't see that. So I was really trying to find those things. And, you know, I came under scrutiny from one or two weirdos that like kind of really pointed out that, you know, they missed him being this kind of this thing. But most of the like, I mean, I escaped hardcore kind of like, no, that's wrong kind of stuff. But there were people that didn't like the fact that he had a like a sort of having lost his way, wasn't, they didn't like that, or that, you know, or that he was ever tender, which was, you know, or ever, but people are not always,
they're not one thing.
Yeah, they're not one thing, and certainly not these creatures that Beckett writes. They're not, I mean, I wouldn't, like Pato says, I he might not be particularly human, but, you know, who cares, you know, is what he says in the next sentence. So it's like very complex and very but super fun when it you know, to jam on it with the kind of people that were there, you know. And so the play was a milestone for me. And I, you know, I don't, it's I think it's gonna be a long time coming before something kind of goes that deep for me. But I, thanks for asking, because I needed to say.
Yeah, I was happy to hear you talk about it, because it's an it's a great play, but it was clear seeing it that it's an extraordinary artistic experience. Not taking anything away from the boy, but the four of you working together, and Jeff's work as,
oh,
it was incredible.
Yeah.
And the two of you paired so well when you talked about the rope and who carried the rope. You know, somebody's always holding the rope. And I thought, right, because they need each other.
Desperately.
And the control. And it was so clear. It was so clear. That's, I mean, it's not just talking about the play, the production. And I like that you all came prepared. I'm not surprised. But I also, that the room was provided for that.
Yeah, I don't know how they would have. I mean, I think we all were kind of really effusive with Aaron before we got there in our initial discussions about how desperately we'll need to be working with those things, because each one of the efforts for just dealing with the rope, just dealing with the whip, just dealing with the watch, just dealing with the little things all the way through, for everybody. You know, the turnip, or the shoes, or the thing, it becomes this Himalayan effort, you know, and requires hours of unraveling and practice and kind of, and but Beckett isn't easy on the actors with that stuff. And but, you know, what we found was, which was kind of amazing, is it like, and so like gratifying, was that if you looked at what he said happened, and you did what he said happened, it worked. You know, it's just a matter of like going like, wait a minute, what did he say happened? Okay.
Let's,
oh, well, that makes perfect sense. And let's do that. And then like, if it presented an obstacle, the achievement of having surmounted it was so satisfying, stage worthy wise, you know, stage wise or staging wise. You're like, oh, of course, the solve is the stage direction. It's not trying to figure out how to do it. The solve is to do it. Do you know what I mean?
I do. You know, I'm going to back up a little bit and say I really appreciate all of this. I could talk about this play for an hour and the production. But what I also liked is you looking at your notes from your teacher.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's, I think had you done the role when he had just told you these things, you would not have known how to interpret the simplicity of those notes.
No way. I would definitely put a lot of polish on it and, you know, try to do stuff and like just kind of because it's incredibly hard to trust it. It's very hard to trust it because, you know, who besides the director is going to tell you whether or not you're onto something? I mean, presuming there's no right way, how do you what's the gauge inside that's like, okay, I think this will fly or this will at least work. I mean, not work, but
right, serve, do it.
Because I can't even tell what Beckett wanted to have work. You know what I mean? Like sometimes you're like, oh, this isn't like you're supposed to suck right now, or you know, or you're supposed to be, but being in control of how badly you suck or what that is also a thing, right? So you like have to like make an incredibly brilliant bad choice. It's so hard to do, you know what I mean? Like or a choice that, you know, because the awareness and strata of awareness and is also continuously shifting. Like, do we take in the audience now, or are we not with the audience, or are we doing something to them, or what are they supposed to be feeling? You know, all that stuff. But yes, going back and looking at it, it's kind of like one of those maps that is only interactive. Like you can't read the map unless you're actually on the road. You know what I mean? So, and I was like, oh yeah, yeah, no. Just, you know, so then I would look at what Alvin said and say, yeah, just simplify, you know, just wait, try to just say it and see what happens, you know? And then it would.
Yeah.
It was really, you know, as the more I laid off it, the more I needed to, the more it sort of shot out, which was crazy. It's a crazy dichotomous experience. But yeah, I would say that, you know, dudes that have done it, guys that are like in the real know, like Alvin, who was a Beckett master and was close to Beckett and all this kind of stuff and was there for the stuff. Yeah, I would not have been able to, interpret it, unless I was actually, you know, amongst very steady hands and really, really full actors, because I don't think I would have had the internal kind of fuse that it requires, unless Mike Shannon was giving me the biz, or Paul Sparks was fucking with my head, or Jeff was weeping in my face. You know what I mean? I don't think that I would have had the impulse to do the things I did without those guys being there to do it. But I don't think I would have had any clue on how to do it unless Alvin had talked me through earlier in my life. You know,
yeah.
a little bit.
Well, also, amazing, amazing gift to have that connection. And historically, I'm going to ask about that. I'm going to back all the way up. Was he teaching you at ART?
ART, yes, at ART. And The great thing about that, I mean, yes, he was teaching me at ART, but I think that the marvelous thing about that conservatory and company at the time was that they were sort of indivisible. It wasn't always like that, and the particular sort of conglomerate of teachers at that time, while you couldn't say, oh, there was a method, there was an incredible, I'd say hodgepodge is a derogatory term, but I would say there's a commingling of techniques and styles and technical training that was really, really, really helpful and I think very amniotic towards bringing the best out of their actors. Alvin, you were part of the company when you got cast, when you got accepted
Accepted.
to the Institute. So you trained during the day, and then at night you played. Whether or not it was in a student production or on a main stage production, you played, and you had to be playing, so that you put your work directly into your playing.
Right, immediately translating what you're getting in the
Immediately translate. Don't wait too long on the notes. Don't. It wasn't really a. I mean, yes, the information was sedimented. And when I got there, I thought, oh, I'll be great because I mean, like, I really had great response on Black Tuesday, which is when you get into the company or when you get into school, you perform the pieces in front of everyone. The day first day, you perform the pieces you got in with in front of everyone. So that's a serious hazing, But that being said. Oh, I had done so well, but then and then I got into class and realized I knew nothing about acting, even though I had been going for so long. I knew nothing, and then the first part that I got was to play Yasha in the Cherry Orchard, and it was in a main stage production. You know what I mean? Because everyone's like, "Oh, you think you're badass? Yeah, we'll see how you do." And I got this part, and it was a nightmare. I mean, I could barely act, and it came out that way. But by the end of my first year, I was so ready finally to do a Chekhov. You know what I mean? And like, then we ended up doing Three Sisters, and it was marvelous. You know what I mean? So like, training is failing. You know what I mean? With
Well, it
under.
has to be, right? Because you're always trying something you don't quite know how to do.
Right. That's it. You gotta fail and fail hard. And chance meeting the prepared mind is also part of learning and training. You know what I mean? When you're ready to sort of take on things, and you are monastic enough to say, I want to learn, and I don't know shit, and I don't have any idea of how to do this anymore. I really, really need to learn how to do it from scratch is the thing. So having come to this Beckett, really having I've ne had never done a Beckett. I had done Ionesco, and it was really great. You know what I mean? But this is wildly different. You know what I mean? And then to learn about where Beckett was in his life during this, and when he won the Nobel Prize, the London Times called his house on an endless loop to try and get a statement from him. And he never picked up, and finally got through his partner, and they asked his partner, she's like, I know who it is, and Sam has told me that I'm allowed to speak for him on this. And they said, what is his statement? And she said, oh, this is the worst. He says it's the worst thing that's ever happened to him, is we haven't won the Nobel Prize. He doesn't want to talk to anyone about it, and everything he had to say about the play is in the play. So if you would like to have one of his thoughts, and he thinks it's just so silly that anyone would think that he would have anything more to say than what's in the text. You
Which
know what I
is
mean?
not a bad way to approach the work
Yeah, playwriting in general. Like, what do I have to say about the play? Nothing. I said it in the
I
play.
said it in the my favorite is whenever they ask for a synopsis of the play. It's like if I could have written it in three sentences, I would have.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. But also he had just, I mean, in thinking about it, I don't really know how to approach the headspace of of it, other than to know some circumstances of what had just happened. I mean, Einstein just came with relativity, and Freud just started talking about things. So you have to assume that Sam Beckett was like, "Yeah, good, good. You've said it already. Now I'm going to write a fucking play. All right. I don't want to deal with it. I don't want to think about it. I want to. I'm just going to play it. You know what I mean?" So like maybe, you know, I don't know.
That's the essence of it.
But
I'm
yeah.
going to jump to a career thing because I know you started young
Yeah.
acting before you went on to training. Besides being, talent is talent, so you're very talented, right? That's not the
Thank
question.
you.
How do you stay? How did you? Because right out of ART, did you? When I forget when like suburbia happened and but I know if I'm not mistaken, you were offered the play, right?
I was before I went to ART, I was offered the play. And then a strange thing happened, which is when I got to ART, Eric Bogosian happened to be playing at ART at the time. And then we were in the middle of one of our first classes with Robert Brustein, which was called the Rep Ideal, which was we discussed the state of American theater, which is always really depressing. But I mean, nevertheless, you know, we discussed the state of American theater, and Eric Bogosian, that was the celebrity guest in Rep Idea. And in the middle of class, he turned and he looked at me and he went, aren't you supposed to be getting ready to do the play I wrote?" And I was like, "Yeah, I am." And then Bob Brustein interrupted that to say, "Well, Ajay's not going to be doing the play. He's going to be staying here to train and doing." I hadn't made that decision. He made that decision for me, but I ended up doing the film when I got out of ART, which was very gratifying and really, really good for me. But in terms of trajectory, I started acting when I was 11 years old. My teacher in school, her son was an amazing actor, a film actor, and there was a big film renaissance in Chicago at the time with John Hughes and all these different people. But she saw an open call in the paper, and because I was wandering around acting to myself, those are just impulses. I wasn't an actor. I was just a doing a lot of Shakespeare to myself because my sister was reading to me incessantly, as were my parents, and I was really into Shakespeare because of the blood and the guts and the sex and the swords and the you know mysticism and the all of the things that all the reasons we love Shakespeare, you know what I mean? All of the things that make us go like, "That's a great, you know, go that
Yeah.
oh, it's, you know, cool." You know, when you're a kid, you know, the same rules apply when you're grown up. Like, "Oh yeah, let's do a play about the devil." You know what I mean? Or let's do a play about, you know. So I was doing that to myself, and she was like, "You know, I think you'd make a really great actor." Her son already was kind of a really accomplished film actor, and is a great film actor, kind of famous and good. A guy called Adam Baldwin, not of the Baldwins, but this other actor. And she saw this open call in the paper, and she's like, and it's the open call was ethnic boy needed to play lead opposite Michael Keaton in feature film being shot in Chicago. And she's like, "I think I would you be interested in going in to for this?" And I was like, "Okay." Anyway, she took me in and then told my mom that she had taken me in, and my mom met us down there at the workplace. And initially there was like 5,000 boys there, and they walked down the line going, "You go, you stay, you go, you stay, you stay." They whittled it down to like 500 guys, and they're like, "Okay, you guys come back tomorrow and we'll talk to you." And when we came then, we did it again, and they walked down the line going, "Hello, you know, who are you, and who are you, and who are you?" And then they got it down to like 100. And then what they did was they broke us up into groups of 10, and they were like, "Step forward of you step forward and you say this one line, and then you step forward and you say the line," which I remember the
Wow.
line was like, "Oh, me, I didn't do anything." You know what I mean? So then they did that, and then they broke it down to like 10, and then they gave us all a C. So this happened over about 4 or 5 days. I want to tell you this story just because I want to tell you how I ended up in the theater. And so he did this, and then like and then they gave us a scene, and they're like, "Come back on Monday with this scene." So I went home, and I learned it for myself. I don't my parents had nothing to do with it. They're like, "You, this is your thing, you know, you do it." So I went in, and then and I did it, and they really liked it, and they were like, "Okay, look, you know, We'll be in touch and stuff like that. So then they were in touch, and then they brought me back in to play that scene again and again and again for like maybe six or seven more times, just playing the scene for the camera and playing with the casting director and trying things. And then they, about a month or so later, we didn't hear anything. And then a month or so later, they called me and they were like, "Well, we'd like you to come to LA to meet Michael Keaton." So I went to Michael Keaton, and we kind of had he took me to ice cream, and we talked. And my mom stayed at the producer's house while Michael and I went out and talked, and then we had a good time, and then they brought me back. And then about a week later, they called me in, and they were like, "We want him to come back in again." And they brought me back in, and there was the producer, the director, and the writer, and they said, "We really love you. We think you're extremely talented, but we're thinking of using Sissy Spacek to play the mother." And I was like, "Oh, great!" You know, and I'm like, "Well, that means we can't use you." And so then I started crying. I didn't know what to do, so I just started crying. And they were all kind of shocked. And they said, "Oh, well, you know, you're very, very talented. You should tell your mother that, you know, you should keep doing this, you know." And I was like, "Well, my mother told me not to get my hopes up, and that she doesn't really have anything to do with this. This is so." And they were like, "Oh," and then I just was crying. And they're like, "Well, you should tell your agent then." And I was like, "What's an agent?" You know, and then they were just sitting there while I wept, and then something overcame me, and I was like, "Well, if I'm so talented, then you should find a new mother." You know what I mean? And then I ran out, and my mom has a different story, but I remember it being that I was standing near the elevator waiting for my mom to get there, and I just felt this big hand on me, and I turned around. It was a producer, and he's like, "Listen, I think you're marvelous, and I think we will find a new mother, and I think we will give you the part." Okay. And I was like, "Oh, okay, whatever, you know." And then we went away, and then but like and then they called and offered it to me later. So anyway, I did these movies, and then I was in that movie, and it was a big deal. And then I started doing movies. So I did like six other projects at the time. And then when I was turning 14, the last thing that I was offered before I quit was to play cockroach on the Cosby Show, because I had just been done this after school special that won all these Emmys. Not me, but the thing itself won. And it was I got offered to play cockroach in the Cosby Show because Anson Williams had directed this after school special. And I turned it down. I was like, "No, I'm going back to being normal and punk rock and, you know, smoke pot with my friends and do all this kind of stuff. And like, I don't want to, this is cheesy and whatever." And I went back. And so then I was in school, and I like, you know, partied and was hanging out, and like, you know, got turned into freshman in high school, and, you know, like having girls and, you know, just whatever it was. And I had already spent like 7 months in Brazil shooting a feature like before this. And I was like, I don't want
I don't want that life.
to, no, I loved it. I loved being in Brazil and stuff like that, but I didn't want to like go do like be a nerd kid in LA. You know what I mean? I found most of the kids that were working my age were not cool. You know what I mean? They were like just weird, you know. And so I went back to high school, and by sophomore year, I was considering dropping out because I couldn't stand the way that the grown-ups dealt with young people, because I had been working with people that treated me as an equal for years. And I was like, this, I mean, seriously, I'd look at my teacher and be like, "What the fuck is wrong with you?" I mean, I would challenge them and be like, "Are you what why are you speaking to me that way? Why don't you speak to me normally?" You know what I mean? And I couldn't, I mean, emotionally, I couldn't quite do anything. And my family was going through a bunch of different things at the time. And so by the time I was 16, I was getting ready to drop out. But in meantime, my high school had like one of the most ambitious theater departments in the country. It wasn't an art school, but like we had like three theaters, like a huge auditorium, a thrust stage, and a black box, and the three theater teachers, and, you know, music. And it was a fabulously highly cultural. And other kids were coming out of that school, Johnny Cusack and DVD Vincenzo and Steve Pinkett, and like, you know, all these amazing artists were coming up out of that school. And so my father, behind my back, went to the theater teacher, who then ended up being like one of the most influential people in my life, went to him and was like, "My son's dropping out. Could you thinking of dropping out. Could you please talk to him? He's an actor. So the guy came and got me out of class and was like, listen, next month we're going to the Stratford Festival in Canada, and there's like four boys and 23 girls going on the trip. Do you, and that was the right ratio. And I was like, okay, yeah, I guess so. To do one, he's like, to see Shakespeare. And all of a sudden something clicked in my mind, and I was like, okay, I like Shakespeare. I mean, I just it, in my bones, I it was like, So we go on this trip, and we get up there, and he pulls me away from all the other kids and takes me out, and we sat together, and he got us a bottle of wine, and we smoked some cigarettes, and he was talking to me about, he's like, why are you dropping out, and like, why aren't you continuing to act and all this kind of stuff. Anyway, we talked, and he was like, no, let's go and see this play. So we get to the theater, and and it's most incredibly beautiful theater, and they blow this fanfare. It's like, what is that? And he's like, yeah, that's the fanfare. That's a call to theater. So, and like, my heart starts racing, and like, we get in this space, and it's this beautiful like thrust stage, and there, and in Canada they don't have exit lights. You don't have, by law, they don't have to have that. So they black out, and this bell rings, dong, and then the backstage, bam. And I said, what is that noise? And he said, that's the backstage door slamming, saying that no one's leaving between now and the end of the play. Oh. And they black out, and it was a complete blackout. And then the lights come up on this pin special on this actor called Colm Feore, and he was doing Richard III, and he started speaking. I was the Winter about Discontent, and I kind of sat up in my seat, and I felt the guy's hand like reach and pull me back. He's like, and I turned to him, and I was like, I want to do this. This is what I want. Because what he was doing to me in that moment, just from the first second he started, I was like, I want to do this. And he was like, okay. And then I stayed in school. So I stayed in school and reversed everything, and only was in the theater, and only wanted to do Shakespeare. And then when I got out of school in Chicago, I out of high school, I wanted to go to conservatory. I auditioned for Juilliard. I didn't get in there, and I auditioned for Royal Academy. I got a call back. They wouldn't take me because they had another Asian actor in London that so they couldn't take an American who was also Asian, because they only took two Americans. And so then I went to Columbia College, which was an open admissions theater school training program in Chicago, and all my teachers were working as directors, and I started asking, can I audition for your play? And they're like, oh, you're the first guy to ask me that. Of course you can. So then I started working in theater in Chicago with my teachers in Chicago, but I desperately wanted to go to conservatory, and I didn't know what to do. So I hung around Chicago, and I went to only theater classes as opposed to the other stuff, right? And then when I did this production of, I got cast in a production of The Good Person of Szechuan, directed by Frank Galati at the Goodman, and Cherry Jones was the lead, and we made friends, and I was talking to her about how I wanted to train and stuff, and she said, well, have you ever considered ART? So I said no, and I looked at it, and I said, oh wow, cool, I think I'll audition. So I got an audition, and I auditioned, and it went really well, but you needed to be able to also write an essay. They're like, they don't take SATs, and they don't do that, but you have to, the essay has to make sense, otherwise they don't take it. So I was not writing the essay because I had no idea, because the question was, why do you want to be an actor? And I had no idea how to answer that, and I was like, for the trophies or for the girls or the, yeah, because I love the whatever it is. So finally one morning, like about 3 days before the thing was due, because I was like, I don't know if I'll be able to make the deadline, and my mom's like, there's a new thing, it's called Federal Express, you can mail it day before, and I was like, okay. She was desperate for me to do this thing, so finally 3 days before it came to me why. And the reason was that I was very lucky as a kid. My parents read to me all the time. My family read to me. I got to see great things, and these things, they spun themselves into sort of uncontrollable dreams that became pathological within me to kind of give rise to in my actual world. Like there was a synapse that was forcing me to play pretend in the now, you know what I mean? And also I wrote that, when I was playing cops and robbers at recess and someone shot me, I stayed dead. You know, I didn't, you don't get to live again once you're dead in cops and robbers. You know what I mean? That's part of the, so I wrote this thing and then my mother sent it via Federal Express and I ended up getting in. And then once I trained at ART, once I got out, which was training there was a whole nother thing. Once I got out, one of my first auditions was to audition for Suburbia, the film. I almost didn't get the audition because my agent at the time was like, you don't speak Urdu, you know? And I was like, but I was going to be, and I was like, but I do, I can. And, you know, so they were like, okay, well, we'll see if we can still get you in and whatever, because I pursued it. You know, I was like, oh, they're making the film of this. I just found out from another friend of mine that happened to. But before I had done that, I got cast in a funny production of Romeo and Juliet at the Denver Center right out of school. And I went there, and while I was there, Frank Galati offered me a production of to play Everyman in Everyman at Steppenwolf. And I kind of had to give 6 weeks notice to the Denver Center because it started. But the artistic director at the time decided to make an example of me and asked me to leave the day before we opened the production of Romeo and Juliet. I was playing Paris, but he was like, no, we don't want you here. If you're going to leave at the end, I was like, but you have tons of kids ready to understudy this and go on. It's not even the big part. And I got this amazing part. And don't you want me to, you know, no, it was not that, but I ended up going back to Chicago and playing Everyman in at Steppenwolf. And, but they followed us American Theater followed us for a year after our graduation because we were sort of a top seeded class and things did not work out for everyone. But it was also, I had the best and the worst year of anyone because my father died that year and all of that kind of stuff. But I just kept acting. So there was nothing else I could do. But then but I was also really into the Asian underground electronic rave movement. So I was doing those things as my other thing that I was doing. And ended up, as time went on, those worlds kind of blended, and I made a solo piece that Phil Hoffman directed for the that Phil Hoffman produced for the lab, and you know, my work was kind of starting to grow. You know, I don't think anyone can really say, you know, be judged on their stuff until they're, you know, well into their 30s or something like that, because, you know, that's all just sort of
building. Yeah.
Forming, you know,
yeah,
so
forming.
Thanks for letting me tell it. I had to spit it because there's no other way for me to tell it. So.
I love the whole story, but I also am always, I'm impressed by the working with Cherry Jones and then Frank Gelati calling. And I think there's something to, you know, thinking about you as a kid saying, if I'm so talented, get another mother, which at the core, a kid has all the confidence in the world to say what they want because, you know, need. But how do you?
I wish I could do that now.
Yeah, don't you wish? When you told that story, I'm like, how do we recapture that? That's so great. But
I'm striving to get back to that kind of thing.
It is, right? Because it's that confidence of belonging and not diminishing yourself in any way.
Exactly.
You know, they're telling you you're great. Well, if I'm great, hire me.
Yeah.
You know?
This is what it is. I mean, it kind of takes that. But I mean, you know, after having been criticized, after, you know, criticism is, you have to learn how to take criticism. I just recently went through something like this with you. I mean, I'm still not good at it. I still, you know, I know theoretically how to do it, take it all in, see whether or not it's one-sided, you know, all that kind of stuff. But my emotional construct is not wired to be criticized. You know what I mean? And it's a huge obstacle in my career, because if I didn't give a shit, then yeah. I would be a lot further along, I think, you know? But it's precisely the thing that makes me give a shit that I think serves me in my acting. Do you know what I mean? So it's like one of those things.
Right.
How do you do it?
Caring is important and
yeah.
we're fragile beings because, you know, somebody didn't see what we were trying to do.
Yeah, it's very dichotomous. I mean, vulnerability is prized above all else. And you have to have a tough skin. So what do you do?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's a conundrum.
Good. It is a conundrum. I wanted to ask how you are I like that the Godot was a regular audition because part of me, I thought it might have been actually.
Very satisfying to get it through a regular audition. Very satisfying indeed, you know.
I want to ask how you stay connected, but actually that world, what do you do to stay in your community, to stay connected to the people you want to work with, is it just honest friendship? Is it reaching out? Is it staying connected? Is it, I know, like, one thing I'm thinking about is like, oh, you did a play with the director from Theatre Complicité, and
Simon.
then
Yeah.
you did another, then you got invited to do one, and then another one, and it's like, are they like, they become peers and friends that you talk about projects with,
They
or
do. They do become peers and friends that you talk about projects with to a certain level, to a certain thing. I mean, everyone is making their own choices. I don't know. I think because of how I came into the first project with him, completely open, and having had some experience, and my most formative, I think most kind of revelatory acting explorations had been in the style that he is a master of, which is Lecoq, clowning and vulnerability. That is when I started to really find how to access certain emotional aspects of acting that always eluded me, even as a kid, even when I was just acting, fooling around, and how to drop those guises and to play from a place of real sort of my own truth, or what I was striving to feel and striving to get to, because I saw what it did to the audience when I was playing from that place, and I was like, "Oh, that's the relationship I'd like to have with my texts and with my audience. I like this kind of work when you bring yourself in that particular way, which is, quite simple. Simple is very thrilling to me." But I have a hard time staying that way. I'm always doing the curlicues and the stuff for, I'm always putting this pizzazz before I
Right,
find
the simple is
stuff.
right, isn't
Yeah.
simple? Simple is about trust.
Right. Which is very tricky, especially if it's you that has to be trusted. So, like, it's like I don't trust myself one, as far as I can, what I mean? So that stuff. So to your question, I'm sorry, what was the question?
Just how do you talk to people about projects and
Oh,
staying
right.
engaged?
Usually, if I like a narrative, any narrative, if I really, really like it, I offer myself to that project in any capacity possible. Because storytelling is a all-encompassing thing. You know what I mean? Like, I don't necessarily have to play the part to be part of this. Do you know what I mean? I want to be a part of it. What that means is that the narrative is of itself. I mean, there's many different ways to come into something. No one is talented at just one thing. If I were there to assist the director, or if I were there to help with fights, or whatever talent I can, whatever, if I really feel a true connection to the thing and know how I might be able to serve it, there's always an opening for that. People are always ready to accept help if they're cool. You know what I mean? If they have no place for you whatsoever, I mean, if you come in subservience to a story that you want to tell, I think that really opens the that kind of really opens people's minds to how you can be a
Be
part of
involved.
it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's tricky, especially if you start to covet
a part or something like that. I think the reason I ended up getting cast in Gatto as Pazzo is because I didn't think of that at all. You know, I didn't even think of myself as any of them. I was like, I just thought, oh well, you know, I could do all of them, you know, or none of them. You know what I mean?
Needed for that play, but that openness always helps. I'm going to be respectful of our time, and I could talk to you, and will continue to talk to you off the podcast, but could talk to you forever. And I think what you just said about bringing yourself of service to a project, offering that, is so great. And I always like to
add, I think the trick for any person trying to work on something or get in something don't just consider, oh, I'm auditioning for this part. You know what I mean? Like, you put yourself in service of the narrative, because that is what's going to either get you involved or not get you involved. I think that the narrative supersedes all of us. You know, what's best for it? You know, what's best for the story is going to get you the part, or not get you the part, or not get you involved. You know what I mean? Or get you involved.
Right. But get you involved gets you. Once you're involved, then, you know, I think about all the circle of people that you've worked with. And it's like, you never know where you're going to go from being involved with one project to the next, you know.
That's right.
Jerry Jones saying, have you thought of ART? And, you know, from there it continues.
Yes, it's always, I mean, it, you know, openness is easily played. You know what I mean? A sense of vulnerability can be a trick, but to actually try to open yourself to these things, truly open yourself to something has to do with the story. It's not about you, it's how the story is told. It's narrative, meaning, you know, it might not serve this story for me to play Pazzo. You know what I mean? It might serve this story for me to be the guy who comes in to teach sleight of hand, or, you know, it might be, you know, it's the idea that we're all encompassing storytellers, and it's the story that's the star. That's Bob Evans too, from Kid Stays in the Picture. The story's the star. It's not you know, Ally McGraw or whoever, you know, that those people aren't the thing. That those people are all interchangeable. You know what I mean? But the story is the star. And if you understand why, you stand a much better chance of being involved. You know what I mean? So I think that for a young actor, someone trying to be part of the theater or be get in movies or do anything like that, I think connecting to the narrative in a very personal way, while that's, you know, that's the start. The other thing is, and not just the part that you want to do, you know what I mean, or the part that you're up for, but like connecting to the actual story of it and what it's, why it's being told, is the kind of the real, that's the pièce de la résistance that's going to get you involved, is to know why you're even doing it. You know, not just because it's cool, you know, right? Not just because the director is awesome and the actors are cool and you want to be in the theater. You know, that's all well and good. Everyone has that.
Right.
But what's the story is the star.
It was a great conversation. Thank you. Thank you, Ajay. Thank you. Just taking the time after such a rich experience with Gatto to talk about all that. And I just loved at the end, loved talking about how can I be a part of this project. in any way. And dude, it reminds me of that's the exciting thing when you're doing a project is when everybody wants to be a part of making it come to life, whether they're in it directing. I think you mentioned assistant directing, or I liked when you said I could be the person doing sleight of hand or whatever your special skill is to bring it to life. When you are excited for the why, people are going to want you in the room. And we talked a little bit, we talked a lot about Godot, but talked to him afterwards about, I directed it about 25 years ago, and it was one of my favorite projects. And my reason was everybody involved, including the assistant director, everybody, once they got into the room, that was the place they wanted to be at the end of their day of coming from a day job or whatever. And it's not rare that people want to be there, but it's that energy of everyone wanting to bring the play to life for a purpose and for a reason. And I thought that was great advice for, you know, how to get part of a project, and is to really be interested and connected to the, not just interested in the why, but connected to it. And if you think it's important, people will want you around. So I love that. I love the whole conversation about process. And I'm excited to, it's funny, he was talking about that being a monumental project, a peak project in his life, career, and, you know, thinking about what's next. And I'm like, right, as we're entering 2024, I talked about at the beginning of the pod, things going on with Get to 11 and starting a new college collab soon, and excited about that, but really looking forward to opportunities we can create as the farm for artists and a relationship with their community. And that's what I think is the focus is going to be for this year, is creating opportunities to present the work in really connected ways with the audience. And I want to say intimate, I'm not sure what that looks like, but building the bond, because I feel like that way people can get artists, early career artists who the farm serves, get focused on why they want to do the play, what is the impact for the audience, and figuring out the best way to build that relationship. And I'm really looking forward to that. I also want to just take a moment to thank everybody. We, you know, can support the farm at any time throughout the year, but we did a big fundraising campaign for celebrating 10 years. And for everybody who supported the campaign, really appreciate it. Makes the podcast possible, but it makes all the work that we do possible. And your support means a lot, because it means you value the work that the farm is doing. And I appreciate that a lot. And with that, we're out.